Hello, I'm Britannia, consciousness coach, trainer, and explorer of what it means to be human. Welcome to Inspiring Global Transformation. I will be interviewing pioneers, thought leaders, and leaders of companies from all over the world. People who walk to a different beat, have chosen a different path, and in doing so are leading the way for global transformation. My hope is that these ideas will inspire, encourage, and support you to get involved or to start something of your very own. This month, I'm lucky enough to interview Steve Johnson. He's somebody who I call my friend, as well as being someone that I really admire. He's had an impressive career, which started as a game ranger and steadily worked his way up, so that now he works with organisations such as USAID, SADC, UNDP and the European Union, to name a few, in creating policies with the aim of protecting his beloved African wilderness. In this podcast, he shares the event that caused him to choose this path in life, how people in far-off countries often intend well, but their actions can cause more harm than good on the ground in Africa, and why he is now focusing on developing leadership within the wildlife management field. I hope you enjoy this interview with some beautiful anecdotes and stories. And here is Steve Johnson.
As a young man, I'd always liked being outdoors, and I grew up in Cape Town, and I used to hike in those mountains in the Western Cape extensively. And the amazing thing is, when I went to live in Cape Town at about 12 years of age, I became a Boy Scout, and we were encouraged to go hiking in the mountains. And from about 13 years of age, on a Friday afternoon, my good friend Osif and I would pack our rucksacks, and we would go off into the mountains for the whole weekend. And we didn't have cell phones and things at that stage. And so two 13-year-olds in the middle of nowhere, out of communications. My parents never, ever worried about it, weekend in, weekend out. Yeah, so that's where the love of nature and the bush came into my being. In fact, it was earlier when I grew up in Zimbabwe on a tobacco farm. That led me to become a game ranger, moving back into Zimbabwe. And then I worked in various national park systems. After that, I moved from Zimbabwe to South Africa. I worked in and helped start the Pilanesberg National Park, the Madikwe Game Reserve. I then moved to become more of a regional player with the IUCN, the World Conservation Union. I ran regional projects for SADC. And then got into working with the development agencies like USAID and European Union and GIZ, etc. All in the space or in the field of wildlife conservation. And so it's been a wonderful journey through 45 years through to, you know, where I am now, still in the game, but more working at the policy level globally and regionally. I've just helped the United Nations Environment Program based out of Nairobi to help their biodiversity and land management section develop their 5-year plan for the future. It's challenging to be able to see the bigger picture and what's needed at that kind of level, and yet still keep your roots in the ground so that you stay true to what's needed, you know, at the coalface and not just in the esoteric level of policy making.
And I mean, you and I have known each other now for years, and we've had some wonderful coffee house chats. And I think most of our conversations have been around leadership, and you've started your own leadership development for conservation, haven't you?
What I realized is one of the greatest weaknesses in our wildlife conservation processes across Africa was there was a lack of professional leadership and management skills in our conservation field. Most of the people who wanted to work in conservation and wildlife management, game rangers as they're commonly called, were people who were kind of loners, who wanted to be out there in the wild, communing with animals, looking after them. They were natural scientists, and natural scientists are very often very reductionist and closed in their thinking. And that didn't make them the best kind of people to be good managers, and especially to be good leaders. And so I was very fortunate to have gone on a trip to America and Canada. I was invited to go on that journey, a 2-month training course. And in Canada, we were exposed to one of their parks where the manager wasn't a natural scientist. He was just a business manager. And all of the people on the course just couldn't get their heads around this. But you know nothing about wildlife. And he says, I don't need to know anything about wildlife. I'm running an organization. And that stuck in my mind. So when I left Zimbabwe to go to South Africa, to Maputo-Tswana, I took with me the notion that I needed to be the one that started this thrust of growing professional managers and leaders in conservation. And my dream was to start a college in the Pilanesberg National Park that I was going to work in. But while I was in Pilanesberg National Park, I also linked in with what was then the Wilderness Leadership School, that used to take businessmen into the park and on a weekend and have them camp out with no tents or anything like that, just a sleeping bag amongst the elephants and the rhino and dangerous animals. And I got into their philosophy of using nature to as the vehicle for teaching leadership. And from that point on, it's been my dream to start my own NGO in that field. Last year, I took the plunge and left that project and started my own NGO called Leaders for Growth, and an associated business side of it, because that's the model people use nowadays with an NGO. There's usually a business element to it. So the business element is called Growth Leaders. And for anyone that's interested in listening, they can go on to www.growthleaders.co.za.
And I'll put a link to it as well in the show notes, so they can find it very easily.
And so that's where I am at the journey now. It's still very new. But the idea is to work with people either to help them become better leaders or to help them become leaders. In all of the sectors that are associated with wildlife and wildlife management and conservation. And it's amazing, a lot of people actually don't understand. This is something that I realized in about 2 or 3 projects ago with USAID, is that we've got our dedicated core section of game rangers and conservationists and environmentalists, ecologists, etc. But the real forces at play in ensuring that we do our job and that we have enough habitat and ecosystems with good integrity and that are functioning, with wildlife populations and everything in them, okay. Those are the conservation agencies, but the people that have influence over that process of whether that those areas exist or not lie in the various sectors, the Ministry of Economic Planning and Development, or in commerce and trade, or in finance. You know, especially finance, in any government, the Ministry of Finance allocates budgets. And so generally the priority in budgets goes to health, education, and those types of things. The poor cousin is always nature conservation and environment.
And yet,
our growth...
It's becoming much more of an urgent matter, isn't it?
Exactly so, yes. And so that's why we've embraced the more kind of holistic process of growth leaders working with any of those sectors, you know, and especially the field I've just come from, which is combating wildlife crime. There you've got the security forces, you know, like in Botswana, the military is very involved, as in Central Africa. The police generally have to be the people that arrest any poachers. There are the customs agencies managing trafficking. They're the immigration people that should be tracking the poachers' movements. There's the tax agencies who are linked, to be doing all of the chasing the money trails. I worked at about 16 different agencies that have an ability to influence whether we succeed or not. So we're going to work with any of those agencies to help them become the leaders, but it's not just in the actual personal development that we're interested in. We're also very keen to understand the bigger picture so that we might do all our training and get the managers and leaders up to scratch, but if they don't have the equipment, the resources, the vehicles to get around, the uniforms, guns, whatever it is, then that training is to naught. So our mission is to work with the bigger resource development, kind of capacity building, capacity in its biggest sense. Okay, so it's all of the above.
What do you think makes you able to see things on that kind of global scale? Because so many people just don't go there. It's like they're frightened of it. I've worked with people in the past and it's like if the vision's too big, it's too scary and they won't touch it. So what do you think makes you excited by that, which other people would turn away from?
There's two things. I'll tell you the very origin of it. Okay. My family, I was born in Zimbabwe and I grew up there until I was about 12 years of age. And when I was 12, in 1964, my family immigrated to Cape Town in South Africa. But many of my friends in Zimbabwe, at Rhodesia at that time, they lived on farms. My dad used to be a tobacco farmer as well. But my best friend, a guy called Rafe Beaumont, he lived just outside of a little town called Marandellas, or now Marandera. And he was a really good friend of mine. And when I'd gone to Cape Town in April of 1964, just before Christmas, he communicated with my parents and said he wanted me to go back to their farm to spend Christmas with them. Now, the amazing thing is, my parents thought this was great. And round about just before Christmas, they piled me on a train in Cape Town, 12 years of age with a passport and a bit of money. And there were five other strangers in and they said to them, look after the guy, and they waved me goodbye. And I was 12-year-old on a train journey of 3 days.
I was going to say, I mean, people that don't live in Africa don't understand the distances. It's a lot.
For 3 days. And it was the greatest adventure of my life. But the real part of the story is that so I arrived there and we got met on the train, off the train, and taken to the farm. Beautiful farm the farmhouse was set on the side of a big hill, what we in Africa call a koppie, where the big rocky granite outcrops these massive big round boulders with trees all interspersed. So we arrived at the farm, and as I kind of went into the house, there I found another five other young men of 12 years age, young boys of 12 years age, and six young girls of 12 years age, okay? And I thought I was coming here to be like your main buddy and everything like that, but there were these other massive group. And as it turned out, my friend was at a private school, I was at a government school. All of the other guys and those girls all went to private schools. I was the only person from a government school. And so I was already kind of on a back foot there. And the second morning the first kind of morning that I was there, we'd all been swimming, and then there was this big thatched kind of gazebo outside of this next to the swimming pool. They all decided that they wanted to play a game, you know, and in the early days of adolescence, there was hormones raging and everything. And so they were going to kind of play a game that they call spin the bottle, and I'm sure everybody's played that.
I think the bottle was still going.
Anyway, so now there were seven boys and six girls, and one of the guys from one of the other friends, he was a bully. You could just see straight away he was like a bully, and he just turned and said, "This game's not going to work because we need six girls and six boys." And he just pointed at me and he says, "You can't play." So I kind of turned to my best friend. I traveled all the way from Cape Town to be there. And I looked at him and I said, "What?" And he said, yeah, well, the game won't work, so you must go, you see. Well, I can tell you, I was absolutely crushed. I just remember that feeling of absolute abandonment and betrayal, you know, just like deep in your gut.
Yeah.
And so I kind of ran off and climbed up on the hill, absolutely sobbing. I'd made all that effort to be with him and everything, and I was just like thrown in the bin, you know, as if nothing mattered. And I found myself at the top of this big koppie on a massive big granite boulder, looking out over almost, you know, nearly 100 kilometers of wonderful Zimbabwe landscape. Beautiful, most of it untouched. And I sat there actually just sobbing and sobbing and just raging inside at being treated this way. And slowly I kind of calmed down. And the funny thing happened, there was a tree that was kind of hanging over this rock, and a turtle dove flew into the branches, and it started softly cooing. And it was just such a calming influence. I could actually just physically feel, nowadays it would be the adrenaline kind of being released, or not released, but kind of diminishing. But the calmness just came to me, and as I looked out over this beauty of the landscape, something changed inside of me, and I said, this is what I'm going to do in my life. I'm going to direct all of this hurt and angst towards something good, and I'm going to protect this beautiful thing. It's so magnificent that it needs to be looked after. And from then on, whatever happened the rest of that holiday was immaterial. I changed, fundamentally changed. And it was with me every second of the day from then on. Right through to today, there's been like a passion to work with others to make sure that we have our wonderful landscapes and ecosystems and wildlife populations that we have, especially in Southern Africa.
Isn't it fascinating? Because I had an experience, not exactly the same, but similar. it was actually when I was doing my training. I was struggling during the training at periodic points, because it was quite intensive. They would ask us to go in front of a video and we had to do various exercises. And I was getting really frustrated with myself because I could stand up in front of the room and I felt I was being myself. But as soon as I went in front of a video camera, it was like I lost who I was. It wasn't there anymore. Okay. So I very innocently got a piece of paper and a pen and I sat down and I decided to go into whatever it was that was blocking me. So I did a bullet point and I wrote down whatever the sensation was and the feeling, and I went deeper and deeper. And eventually I put down alone. And one sort of solitary tear trickled down my face. And I kind of thought, oh, okay, I've figured out what it is that's, you know, the trigger for all of this nonsense. And then, oh my God, then the floodgates just opened. I ended up crying. So, you know, when you start making animal noises, it's not pretty anymore. It was like that. And I didn't know what to do. I felt like this wounded animal. And I was so embarrassed and distressed and all these emotions. Eventually, I took myself off down to the beach, because luckily it was actually in Cape Town as well. And I took myself off down to the beach and I walked along and I found a pier. And I sat on this pier and I just allowed myself to feel every moment that I'd ever felt alone in my whole entire life. And I cried and I sobbed and I made horrible animal noises. Eventually, it all cleared and passed. And I realized I'd never, ever been alone ever in my entire life. And it was just this clarity that, mm-hmm. you know, it's just an illusion. That all that stuff is just, I don't know, it's just not real. And the truth is just there. And ever since then, I don't think I've ever felt that alone that I'd felt before.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm just sort of wondering, in the process of transformation and things like that, how does what we sort of similarly experienced that gave us this amazing clarity? I mean, it's not easy always to get to that space. Is it necessary?
You know, in the leadership space, the key thing that a lot of the people who speak about leadership talk about, the key attribute is integrity. Okay, a leader needs integrity. He has to be somebody that is believable and can be trusted. Okay, if you don't have those things, then you don't have anyone that's going to follow you. They won't trust you. And how do you get that integrity? Well, integrity is mixed up and made up of values and all of the kind of moral attributes that our upbringing has given us or not given us. Okay, that's another key part. And in emotional intelligence, it's understanding yourself that is the key thing. At that moment on the rock, I began to understand myself.
Yeah.
Okay. And I found resilience in myself, a confidence in myself. No one was going to bully me again. No one was going to. It's that kind of aura that I've got around myself. You know, no one can touch it. It's just, you can say what you like, you can do what you like. It might bother me, but it's not going to hurt me. Okay.
There's a truth, isn't there? It's when you can see your own truth.
Yes.
And you realize that no one can actually ever break it, damage it, hurt it, or anything.
Yes. And in kind of the stuff that I've been writing recently, it came to me about 2 days ago that I was listening to something. And if you can stand in your power and own your own truth, those two things together, that to me brings out that if you look at the real true leaders, okay, they can stand in their power and they can speak their truth. Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela.
I years ago, actually, when I was still in Botswana, I was trying to find a definition of power. And I was struggling with the word power, because when you say somebody's powerful, it doesn't always bring a nice feeling. I've since realized it's authentic power that I was kind of trying to sense in a way. And my definition that I came up with, and I can't say that I came up with, it was given to me. It was an inspired thought. It certainly didn't come from my head. Was that authentic power is a person's ability to hold space for their being. I think that's what you're talking about.
Yes. And I'm just going to get something as we're talking now. But to me, you said, like, how did I get to this point? So it was that instance in my youth that allowed me to get this guiding light, this direction, this ability to work at a higher level. You were asking me how do I see this stuff at scale and everything like that. I think that at that very young age, I realized how, you know, what 12-year-old person sits on a rock and looks at this beautiful landscape and says, I'm going to be the person that looks after this stuff. You know? But like, I don't know where it came from, but it just was in my head that it was my calling to do that.
It's a nerve.
Yes, and it's been a confidence in me standing in that power. That I've always been somehow, as I said, in Zimbabwe, I happen to be one of the people that kind of rose through the ranks much quicker than most of the other people. And I think it's something that the senior people in the organization saw in me and trusted and saw that there was some bigger perspective and vision that was deep inside me, and you might call it passion or whatever it is. But I'm going to show you for those out there. There's a fantastic book.
And I'll put a link to it again in the notes as well. So
cool.
What's the book?
It's a book called Power and Love. Okay.
Ooh, I haven't heard.
Yeah, and it's by Adam Kahane.
Okay.
And it talks about it's a theory and practice of social change. And it talks about how these two elements, the power and love, you know, can be contiguous and almost one at the same time. That within power can be love and within love can be power.
When I talk about authentic power, the basis of it is love.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It's not a fluffy, soft kind of love. It can be quite a firm.
Yep.
Love can say no, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And the amazing thing is that I've found it much easier now, having read that book, to talk to other people that are senior professionals in wildlife or whatever sphere, like about love. They're often men, especially, like when you say, oh, talk about love, they're like, hey, I get all like uneasy and like, they go there, it's like soft and you know, not loud. But when you equate it to be in the same kind of, it's like the yin and the yang, they're intertwined, you know, then they can get it and say, okay, fine, we'll talk about it. But when you stand in that power, you're standing often in that power with the perspective of love.
I see it as well that love is when you're open. I kind of, if you're taking things to their most basic level, to me, there's love is on one side and fear is on the other. And love is when you're open,
right,
and you're allowing energy to flow through and connect. And fear is when you close the gates and you pull back and you have stuff between you and the next person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's that love, that openness, that is what we're talking about when you ask me the question of like, so what allows me to see this bigger picture, this scale, is my mind transcends all of the things. I love going into a village and working with the people in that their scale and their culture and their individuality and their absolute personal needs in life at that village level, subsistence, where, you know, I'm just thinking of the Tubu community in northern Botswana. I worked with them for 18 months and spent much time in the village. And I got to know most of the 1,200 people that were part of the village, and their needs and aspirations and everything. And I can scale that up into working with United Nations Environment Program to develop the global perspective for biodiversity and land management. Because that kind of love gives me that clarity, that openness of mind, that I don't shut things out. I'm curious and fascinated by the quest for knowledge. And I can put all those building blocks together from the lowest level that kind of aggregate upwards and come out with a bigger picture that speaks the truth. Okay. And a current bit of the journey I'm on at the moment with some very good colleagues of mine is the journey of truth that if we want our wildlife populations in Southern Africa, in Africa, to survive the next 30 years, and I give you 30 years, okay, and I'll tell you why now. If we want them to survive the next 30 years, we have to trust those communities to be the good people that they are, the good, intelligent, capable people that they are. Every single person that I've ever come across in the most subsistence of villages is a wise, wise person with a depth of local intelligence, okay, yeah. Based upon experience.
There's a wisdom that kind of sometimes gets lost when
people
move to cities and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. And even if it's not all in one person, like we in the West try to have everything in one person's head. I remember once working with a Tubu community, and there was a complex thing that came up. And they said, we don't know what to do. And I said, no, within you as a community, there's something, you know, you can come up with. And then they sat there and they said, no. You must tell us, you see, you're the guru or whatever. I said, no, the wisdom's actually in amongst you collectively. Okay. And they sat there and they reflected and I let them. I went off and had a cup of tea and came back and they were all sitting and chatting quietly. And then they said, yeah, you're right, Mr. Johnson, yeah. Bertha's brother is a lawyer in Johannesburg. We'll get him involved. And he can then direct us as to what to do. And I said, there you are. You know, you came up with the own thing yourself. And so there's this beautiful, beautiful wisdom and in the simplicity. of them being able to manage their lives, their situation, their context, the land that they live on and depend upon. And those that have the wild animals on them, the elephants and the lions that eat their cattle and the elephants that trash their crops or whatever it is, they are the stewards. They are the custodians of those animals. Many of your listeners might not know, but in our part of Africa, our national parks, game reserves, etc., only contain 40% of the wildlife that we have in southern Africa. 60% of our wildlife lies in areas that are managed by communities and a little bit on private land.
It walks through towns and stuff. I was recently actually talking to Larry Patterson, and he was saying that there's a small little village in Botswana. They've been tracking a lioness, and they couldn't believe it, but every night she went to sleep behind the police station right in amongst the town, and people were walking past all night long and they didn't know that there was this lioness sleeping there right next to the police station. And people in Europe and stuff, I mean, that's just incomprehensible, but
totally.
It's lovely out there.
And the thing that we can't miss, okay, is just take Kruger National Park, okay. It's got a huge thrust of poaching on it to kill and harvest the horns from the rhinos, okay. And if the international organized crime syndicates that are driving all of this process to get the rhino horn and the ivory, if they really wanted to, they could just get in there and those rhino would be gone in a flash. Likewise on other protected areas. But in the communal areas, it's the people's choice whether those animals stay or not. And I was just telling you, going to the point of that the current quest that I'm on, is if we don't let those communities get an equitable share of benefits, financial, economic benefits from having to live with those animals that are taking their cattle or crashing their crops, if they don't get something back, then they have no investment in making sure those animals stay there. Okay, they'll see them as a problem and kill them. Okay.
Yeah. There's actually a debate in Botswana, hasn't there, about the elephants?
Yeah, but it's all over. You know, it's across our whole region. And you know, my example is East Africa. You know, the wildlife populations there across East Africa have been decimated. Okay. Because the government says, and just for your listeners' perspective, before colonial rule, tribal people had their own special customs and ways of managing the wildlife populations. And there were certain things you couldn't hunt at certain times because the animals were breeding. You couldn't hunt certain species because there weren't very many of them. Okay, and that could change from over the decades or whatever it was. So they had their own little tribal rules and norms and mores, as we call them. Along came the colonial governments and said, government owns all the animals, you don't own the animals anymore, and we'll let you have some of them to hunt for the pot. And in the intervening 100, 200 years, the people on the land with the wild animals said, well, if we're not going to get anything value out of it like we used to centuries ago, then we're just going to kill them. And that's happened in East Africa flat out. Okay. We used to have in many thousands of years ago, 25 million elephants in Africa. Okay. In 1974, we had 1.3 million elephants in Africa. Okay. Today, we have 450,000. Okay. So a third of those 450,000 are in Central, East, and Western Africa. 300,000, or two-thirds of them, are in Southern Africa. In East Central and Western Africa, those elephants are being hunted at a rate of about 20,000 a year. So if you actually just do the quick maths in your head, those 150,000 elephants will be gone in just over a decade. We will have ours still here because we're only losing less than 1,000 elephants a year in the whole of Southern Africa. Okay. So the push is on to make sure that we in Southern Africa, who have looked after our wildlife, are able to look after it into the future, and we do it properly. My point, though, is But because the communities weren't given any benefits and rights over those wild animals in East Africa, Central, etc., they didn't see any reason to be the custodians and the protectors and the guardians, okay,
yeah,
of those wildlife populations. We in Southern Africa have done that very successfully. You know, Namibia is a prime example where they've formed these community conservancies. The government has said, once you're registered and you've got your act together with kind of rules and constitutions and everything like that, your bank accounts, etc., we'll give you any animals that are on your land. You manage them and control them. You together with us as guides, we can kind of use them, capture them, sell them, do what you need to and get money out of them and use that to look after your people. They are so proud at the way they have got that to happen over the last 20 years that those wildlife populations have blossomed. Where they were down to very kind of almost sub-viable populations, they now have huge populations in the Caprivi. We started that process just over 20 years ago, where with one or two small little communities and they formed a conservancy. They have 160 conservancies across Namibia now. And the same thing in Zimbabwe, campfire program, to a lesser degree in Botswana. And so, you know, it's just the quest is to make sure that we trust those people, let them do what they need to do to manage those populations. And we cannot let the international body dictate to us how we must manage our wildlife in Southern Africa. You know, we're the people that live with the people. We're the people that live with those wild animals. We know what the problems are. We know how to sort them out. But there's this massive pressure from principally Europe and America to interfere in the whole process. And it's complicating the situation so badly that it's making our job so hard. And we know we can do it, but you know, the global conventions and all the rest are interfering with us.
It's that assumption that other people know better. You know, that people that haven't got any experience in a certain situation know better than the people that are living in it. It's
yes.
Funny, you're talking about this and my mind is kind of going to, okay, we're talking about wildlife and wildlife conservation. But actually what you're talking about could be scaled to any situation. It doesn't yep. just around about wildlife. And it's interesting, just the power dynamics sort of globally and how countries respond to things like, we're all in this coronavirus thing. It's just, it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, you know, and it's just, let me give you a quick example. You know, elephants in game reserves, etc., they die naturally. Okay, and so you come across, the game rangers come across them, and they're the tusks, they're the rhino horns, they're there. They take them off and they're stored in big warehouses. And if they catch poachers with big containers or amounts of ivory or horn, those are confiscated through the process, and those end up in these same big warehouses. So across Southern Africa, each of the countries, Namibia, Botswana, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Malawi, they've got these big warehouses full of ivory. In Zimbabwe, their warehouse has $600 million worth of ivory. $600 million worth of ivory. There's a value locked up in that, okay? They're locked up in the big warehouse. And I'm not promoting trade, okay? But what I'm saying is, if somehow that value could be unlocked in some clever innovative mechanism, I don't know, cryptocurrency or whatever it is, if it could be unlocked and applied to the national park system in Zimbabwe, they would be able to manage their parks, etc., and reserves far better than they are at the moment, where they are under massive pressure. They don't have money for uniforms, they don't have money to put fuel in their vehicles.
Yeah.
The vehicles are old and falling apart, you know, and I can go on and on. You know, they're battling to keep some cohesion in their management processes. And yet there's 600 million that could be somehow accessed. I don't know how, we need to explore that. But those are the things that we're not allowed to access that because there are international agreements conventions that say X, okay, and that X says, well, that's not allowed to happen and you're not allowed to sell those at Ivory. Fine. We need to be able to innovatively and creatively, and I hope this COVID-19 pandemic thing somehow unlocks a whole bunch of new thinking that'll allow us to move towards some more equitable thing. But to go to your point, if those people who meddle overseas that actually have no investment in the situation in our country, they sit in their armchairs in Britain or in America, they're people living in towns or in a flat in New York with a perspective and a position, and they create enough energy amongst people by using the media, social media. And then it results in new laws being brought in European Union or in Britain, in your own British situation. There's a thing currently going through Parliament to ban the importation of trophies of wild animals hunted for sport. Okay. That's been dreamt up by some armchair conservationists in Britain. Okay. I don't know if they've ever been to Africa. I don't know if they've ever been to be in a village where elephants come and trash the people's crops that they've spent 3 months plowing and planting and weeding, and it's gone in the night. Okay. Or their cattle, five of their cattle are killed by a pride of lions, and they've only got... Have they ever been there and seen the anger and the trauma and the impoverishment that leads to? You know, those families in that little village have spent 3 months, that's going to be their food for the whole season, and it's gone. Or their cattle, that's going to be that they can eat that over the coming year, it's gone.
I think people in Europe and, you know, Western society, and they don't understand how little those people live off. You know, to us, it would be unheard of to live off that little amount of money that people do. I mean, you know, the cattle and the crops, that's the bulk of their livelihood.
Huge, huge. You know, many of those people, I would guess, live off less than a dollar, maximum less than $4 a day, okay? Less than £2 or £3 a day.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, it's minimal. They do.
It's incomprehensible to somebody living in our society.
Yes, yeah. And yet they do, and then they live and they survive and they're happy and they're healthy. Obviously, they would like a better life, but wouldn't be all. But that's where they find themselves in, their culture and their people and everything are there, so they stay and they want to be amongst them. I and a group of quite a lot of our friends just find it kind of unacceptable that people who really don't know what they're talking about and bringing a single-minded perspective, a species perspective, okay, that's what we call it. They want to save the elephant at all costs, not understanding the big picture of how a herd of elephants can come through a forest and over years totally change it. Like the Chobe forests in northern Botswana that you're familiar with, okay. Those forests have had such an aggregation and compacting of elephant populations to densities that are above the carrying capacity that they eventually start to outfeed the ability of the vegetation to feed them. So they start pushing over trees, they modify the habitat. And now those habitats have existed over hundreds and thousands of years. And so you will get sable and roan and everything that find their little niche to live there. Along come the herds of elephant that are now crowded in there. They change the habitat. And so it pushes out the sable, it pushes out the roan and sesame and all those specialist feeders. And what you have is you actually diminish the biodiversity in the area.
Yeah.
And how do we get to that point? Well, it's either human development that constrained the elephants into that position, or these international processes and forces that said, well, you can't do this, you can't do that, whatever, you know, and we find ourselves handcuffed, you know, and our legs in chains as to we know what we should do, but we're not allowed to do it.
And it's about value. If something has value, then people will look after it.
Absolutely.
But if you take the value away of it, so if they, I mean, I'm personally, I once, when I lived on a farm, I went on a hunt, and it was for people, was actually for a very poor family that were looking after the grading the roads. And I was in pieces, so I was banned. I'm just never allowed to go hunting ever again. So I'm not a fan of hunting, but I understand how it plays an importance in a society. Because people come and they give money to that society for the privilege of hunting something. So I understand it gives value to the animals. And game farmers, if they can't get value from the animals, then they just won't have game farms, the privately owned ones. Because
let me give you a bit of a story here. So when I moved out of Zimbabwe into South Africa, the northern portion of South Africa, what was then the Northern Transvaal or now Limpopo province, the majority of that landscape, huge area, massive area, almost the size of Britain itself, okay. It was predominantly tobacco farming, maize farming, and cattle ranching. Those three things. That's what you found across the landscape with the farmers. With the new policies and approaches that we promoted in what was then the Bophuthatswana National Park system, we promoted hunting and the ranching of animals and the capture and translocation and sale and trade in animals. Okay. And it became so lucrative that almost to a farm across that whole province, okay, the whole northern piece of South Africa is transformed. You find very few tobacco farms, very few maize farms, very few dedicated cattle farms. Okay, what you find now are a plethora, hundreds, if not thousands, of game farms and game ranches that have lodges and tour operations on it, and they cull the animals and sell the meat, they sell the skins, they bring in hunters to hunt for the pot. Sometimes they bring in some hunters to hunt for sport. But it's transformed the whole area to be this massive industry. I think it's, if I know my figures correctly, something like a 250 million rand industry a year, just in that one province. Okay. Yeah. Because we gave the animals value, people have let them grow. There's some people are making the case. I know it's the same in America, but they're making the same case in South Africa, that because of our conservation efforts, largely based upon the back of some form of hunting, whether it's recreational hunting or whether it's sport hunting professionally, but there's more wild animal numbers, individual animals in populations across species in South Africa and in America than there were 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And what does that tell you? It's because we're doing something right. As abhorrent as hunting might be, I used to be a professional hunter for a very short space of time. I didn't like it at the end of the day, and so I stopped doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's understanding, whilst you might not, and I think that goes for humanity as a whole, it's the understanding of each other. It's not expecting people to be the same as us, but understanding yes. how the whole works together.
Yeah, and it's this reductionist kind of radicalization of things, I think. To me, I've always worked on life is a balance, it's a compromise. And ecology works with diversity, and simplicity. So the more diversity you have in a system, the shocks that it experiences in the system makes it more resilient. Okay, that you've got the diversity, because if this part fails, you can rely on the other parts. But for example, if as America has happened in America and a lot of other places, if your agriculture becomes just hundreds and thousands of hectares of just maize or some sunflowers or whatever it is, okay, and then a blight comes in, some kind of pest comes in, it'll wipe out that whole industry. Yeah. Whereas if you had patches of this kinds of plant, not monoculture but multicultural planting, so you'll have different types of crops at the same time, at different times, etc. So if one crop fails because of a bug, then you've got the other stuff to kind of fall back on. And so I like your thinking. So if we were all to think the same, then we would lose that resilience in our social systems. But there are people who want everything to be the way they think. Okay? And sadly, it's often people who live in kind of places in Europe and America with no real expertise, just a passion and a lot of empathy. And they just want to see things done their way.
Yeah. It's fascinating, really, how the evolution of the world, you know, what drives it, and this power that people want to enforce over other people. It's interesting to me because it sort of comes back to what you were saying about working with the local villages and trust. It's like trust has gone from our society, trust and belief that others know what is best for their culture, for their society. And actually trust in ourselves.
Yeah.
That we know what's best for us.
I'm going to quote you something out of a book that kind of speaks to the issue, where it talks about practical intelligence and analytical intelligence, like you have emotional intelligence. It's the practical intelligence that I think a lot of people are missing. There's a lot of analytical intelligence. So those people that are sitting in their armchairs in London or wherever they are, in Manchester, whatever, and have heard or read a book or something like that, or seen a thing on TV with David Attenborough, and they've analyzed what's been said there, and they're saying poor elephants, they're dying, and look at, you can't see, it's not it's a podcast, but in the back behind me is, I've got pictures of elephants, and they say, oh, poor elephants, they're dying, etc. We've got to save them. Okay, they have no understanding of elephant management and how elephants are destructive they can be, and they sit in their armchair and say, I have the answer. Okay, I have the analytical intelligence to realize that we've got to do something, but they don't have the practical intelligence of the implications on the ground of living with elephants and managing elephants and protecting elephants. And I think that's where there needs to be a balance. People need to have a balance between the analytical intelligence and the practical intelligence to allow it to interface and to say, okay, there's a compromise somewhere here. Life is all about balance and compromise.
There's two things that are coming up for me. The one thing is, if people are listening to this and it's making them pause and stop and think, what can people that are sitting hundreds and thousands of miles away and want to make a difference and want to be proactive, what can they actually be doing?
You know, I think the first thing is
because it comes from a good place.
No, it's wonderful. It's wonderful, and I don't decry it. I always say you need, in society, you need the outliers, okay? James Caldwell wrote a brilliant book about outliers. You need the people on the fringes on either side, okay? The people that are radical liberal and the people that are radical conservative, okay? People don't want anything to change, and people want everything to change, okay? You don't want anything to change ever. We want things to change very fast. Okay. None of that works. Okay. Whether it's radical, fundamental religion or whatever it is, those things on the periphery are there to make sure that the bulk of common sense lies in the middle. Yes, and it makes you think and not get too kind of
comfortable.
In your own space, and that you don't think about what could happen. So what could they do? Well, firstly, I think people need to not be myopic. They need to have, okay, fine, I really think elephants need to be saved, but I'm going to read up as much as I can about it, and then I'm going to understand both sides of the argument, and then I'm going to see that the solution side lies somewhere in the middle, okay? And then that's the part I'm going to go and promote. But when you let this emotion, because you actually don't know that much about yourself, if you actually go and look at the four pillars of emotional intelligence, the self-awareness element to me is one of the fundamental things. If you don't know yourself, okay, and what triggers you and pushes you in a certain direction, then you
what a trigger is.
yeah. Okay. So there's that self-awareness and self-control comes with that. Okay. But then there's the social awareness. I think that's the next step in that process is, so if you do understand yourself, then you need to understand how you and your thinking interacts with other people's self-awareness. Okay. And what your thinking does impacting on the other people. So you can't impose your self-awareness on other people's self-awareness. So you can't be your armchair person in Manchester, okay, and impose your understanding, your worldview, your perspective on the people who live in the Tubu village in the Okavango Delta. You don't even know them. You don't know their culture. You don't know their background. You don't know
their troubles are the challenges.
You don't know what absolute poverty. I was telling you about that village of 1,200 people. Can you understand 10 people in that job have in that village have formal jobs? Out of 1,200, 10, I'm showing my two hands here, 10 people have formal jobs. Can you even begin to understand that level of unemployment? Your people that are going to listen to this podcast, I beg you, just try and imagine your society where...
And there's no safety net. I mean, in England, there's a government that looks after you. There's nothing in Africa.
Yeah. The only safety net they have is what they can scrounge off the environment or from the natural resources, okay? Or the little meager crop that they've grown or tried to grow in those very arid kind of areas with poor soil. And so when you've spent 3 months plowing in the blazing, blistering African sun and going out and planting the seeds, which is a laborious job, and then applying the pesticides and the fertilizer and then weeding the crop on a little acre plot. And if that crop actually kind of comes to fruition, you've got food for your family for the whole year.
And that's a good year.
And then in one night, five elephants come and it's all gone. Can you even begin to imagine, I'm asking your listeners now, can you even begin to imagine the panic that you get into? And I'm hoping this COVID-19 panic might bring, pandemic, might bring some of that understanding to people now who've suddenly lost their jobs and a lot of work. Where do I get my next meal from, etc. I hope there's this greater understanding that emerges out of it from these millions of people around the world that have been put into that situation that some people experience every day of their lives, year in and year out, yeah. Not just when COVID-19 comes. And it's a massive lesson. And I think about this COVID-19. In some ways, it's a process that's been brought to us to kind of bring us back to reality, to bring us to our knees so that we get a little humility.
I also see it as a liminal space. And I only learned about what a liminal space was a little while ago.
Right.
It's a space of transformation, of stepping from one reality into another. And I love that. I've got another podcast that I do called Evolution of Self. And I've just done a one on liminal space and transformation.
Well, I'd love to hear it. But I think that's exactly it, this liminal space. I hope people are actually sitting and reflecting and beginning to have some empathy, really.
Also, I think what you said right at the very beginning of this as well is that if a village or a society can see value in looking after the wildlife, then they become custodians of wildlife rather than the people that are fighting against it.
Exactly.
And I think that's so important, that if we understand and we give power back to those villages so that they are able to extract value from managing their own environment, then there's a massive change, rather than taking it away and saying, well, actually, you have no idea, I know better than you.
Yeah. And treat them as normal human beings, as intelligent, kind of thinking, feeling human beings with emotions and the ability, some wisdom, collective wisdom, if it has to be, to solve their own problems. And I don't know a single community that hasn't in some way ever been able to solve the problems they face, unless these are macro level things like the pandemic or where a government kind of policy just forces them into abject poverty. But you know, I want your listeners to think about this. Do you even know what the experiences, feelings, needs, and wants and emotions are of those people? Let me leave this in your mind. In a village, in a rural village, the Tubu village, there's a little cluster of huts, and there's like the grandfather and the grandmother, and then maybe two or three married couples with their maybe five children each. Okay, so we're talking about quite a few children there. Okay, and they are dependent totally on their natural resources. They will go and harvest the fruit. They will dig for roots and feed off some of the roots. They will go in some of those areas of the delta where there's like swampy areas, there's a certain thing called a water lily. Okay, they dig the roots, the tubers out of that, and they make delicious food out of that.
And not only that, not just for food, but also for housing. They live off the natural resources. Their whole environment is full of what they've gleaned from the environment.
But in that same context, one of the most traumatizing things I've ever experienced in that same village context, okay, was in Malawi, driving near Cape Maclear in a vehicle to go and visit a community. And there was a woman in a field of grass on my left-hand side with a baby on her back. And I asked the driver to stop, and I went across to her with a translator, and I said, like, because I could see she was doing something with the grass, you see. This was in a drought. And I asked to the interpreter, what are you doing? She says, I'm collecting the seeds from the heads of this wild grass into this little bowl. And it was a bowl that was maybe a cup or two, our normal teacup or two, okay. And she'd collected it about half full. And I said, what are you going to do with it? And she said, we have no food. And she was skinny, you know, very, very thin from starvation. She said, I'm going to go home and I'm going to pound it and grind it and put some water with it. And it will be the milk that will feed the baby on my back for one more day. And I can tell you, tears came to my eyes that people are reduced to that level of living, to that level of having to withstand that absolute trauma. And my throat, even as I speak now, I even get kind of, my eyes are welling up. I hope I never see that again, a scene like that, okay? That somebody is forced into doing something like that. And I wonder if any one of your people that might listen to this podcast would ever be able to imagine that. I've never been in that situation, but I can tell you it was absolutely traumatizing for me, never mind for that person. And yet we stand in judgment of them because they want to get some value out of the wildlife on their land and use that money to buy school fees, to pay school fees or buy school uniforms or buy food, buy shoes for them to go to walk to school.
You know, it's
to get water from a borehole or a water point without having to walk 8 kilometers there and 8 kilometers back every day. You know, many people don't even understand the hardships our rural people in Africa go through.
Something that's coming to me very strongly just through this conversation, and it's almost a summing up of it, and that's as a humanity, we need to spend less time fighting each other and making each other wrong, and more time loving each other and understanding each other. Because actually, absolutely, the solution isn't about telling everyone not to do stuff and how to behave. It's about working together and understanding each other. And that's where the solution is, not in fighting each other.
And that understanding that allows us to love each other and work with each other and want the best for the next person, it just goes back to empathy. You ask, what can they do? What can they do to this journey? Okay, go and look up the definition of empathy. Okay, Google it. Understand it deeply. And then start to apply it. in their judgment of the people that hunt or want to go and get some benefit out of those elephants, etc., that are on the pictures on the wall behind me, or want to live a kind of way that is their way of that they've lived for millennia as people in Africa, without having stuff pushed down their throats by people in, and I love to say Manchester. My dad came from Manchester.
I was wondering why Manchester was a big thing. poor people in Manchester, poor Nigerians.
Yeah. And my dad was one of the most wonderful people on earth. And we kind of, to round it all up, you know, he had this massive love for everybody else. You know, he one of the values he instilled in me was to treat other people with respect and love and try to see the good in everybody and not the bad and to be in judgment of them. And so as we close out this, you know, that's the kind of takeaway is before you judge us in Africa, understand us, know what we feel, know what our emotions are, know what drives us and what forces are at play that are pushing us to be who we are. And when you know that completely, then judge us. Then you can have your perspective and tell us what to do, okay? But unless you walked in our shoes in Africa, don't. Because many of our people in Africa in the rural areas don't even have shoes.
Absolutely, yeah. And to me, coming back to what Gandhi said, it was be the change. Instead of trying to change what's out there, we need to change what's in here.
Yeah.
That's where the big change happens. If we all focus on changing ourselves and being better people, then the world will just automatically change. Thank you so much. That's been really fabulous. And it's really, truly lovely to speak with you.
I am Britannia, and you've been listening to the Inspiring Global Transformation. If you've enjoyed this, make sure you subscribe. And if you have a moment, we would love to hear from you. So please leave us a review. If you want more from me, I have blogs, videos, meditations, courses, social media links, and more on my website, www.britannia.com. That is BRITTANYA.com. Thank you so much for listening, and lots of love from me to you.